Welcome to Health Yeah, where experts from Stony Brook Medicine come together to discuss topics ranging from the complex inner workings of an infectious disease to tips and tricks for staying safe and healthy all year long.
Well, welcome everybody, and thank you for joining us for what we expect and hope will be a very informative conversation about breast cancer. It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we're very excited to participate in this conversation, and we're very happy that you joined us. My name is Dr. Brian O'Hay. I'm the director of the Carol Baldwin Breast Center, and I'm also one of the breast cancer surgeons here. I have Dr. Alex Stessen here with me today, and Dr. Jules Cohen. And Dr. Stessen, tell us about yourself.
So thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Alex Stessen. I am a radiation oncologist specializing in breast cancer, and I've been here for 10 years working with Dr. O'Hay and Dr. Cohen as part of our breast cancer management team.
Great. Dr. Cohen?
Hi, I am Jules Cohen. I'm a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer. I've been at Stony Brook for 14 years and working with Dr. O'Hay and Dr. Stessen and others very closely.
Great. Thank you, guys. So first of all, one of the main focuses of the work we do is our participation as a multidisciplinary team. I think we would all agree to that we have multiple specialties working and as a tight group together, something that an academic medical center can do and others maybe can't. So I think that benefits the patients greatly, and I think we all learn from each other as we all work together in making group decisions about patient care and patient interests. So those are the things we'll talk about today, plus some things that are on people's minds by way of the most common questions asked in Google searches. We'll try to answer some of those today, and then we'll go from there. So first of all, I think one of the first things that occurs and one of the first things I think about is when someone asks or considers lumpectomy versus mastectomy. That's certainly a very important topic. And I know as a surgeon, we offer both of those. What does that mean to you, Alex, as a radiation oncologist? What does that mean to you, lumpectomy or mastectomy, and some of the hard decisions a woman is trying to make about that?
Yeah, so we as radiation oncologists come in after surgery, typically, right? So radiation is one of the mainstay modalities of treatment for early non-metastatic breast cancer. And it follows a surgery, whatever that may be, lumpectomy or mastectomy. And traditionally, most women who undergo lumpectomy get radiation afterwards as part of the breast conservation paradigm. So the radiation kind of takes place of a completion mastectomy. Whereas after a mastectomy, you have to have a reason to have radiation, right? And those reasons could be that the cancer traveled to lymph nodes or that there was a little bit of cancer left behind where the surgeon cut, with what we call positive margin, or that the primary cancer was very big. But barring any of those scenarios, the mastectomy can actually help somebody avoid radiation. We can talk about, you know, what the radiation entails and whether it's, you know, it makes sense to get a mastectomy just to avoid radiation, or sometimes it's better to get a lumpectomy and have both.
Sure, those are very, very good points. Dr. Cohen, what does it mean to you when someone is debating or considering lumpectomy or mastectomy? What does that mean to you from a medical oncologist?
Sure. I try to clarify with the patients that the extent of surgery is not really related to the overall outcome from the breast cancer, that there are times where patients need a mastectomy because of the size of the tumor or the fact that the tumor is affecting multiple different parts of the breast, or the patient has a genetic abnormality that predisposes not only to that breast cancer that they may have now, but a future breast cancer. But I generally advise patients to have as little surgery as is necessary to cure them of their breast cancer, because nobody dies from breast cancer in the breast. The lethal form of breast cancer is metastatic breast cancer, which is breast cancer that has spread beyond the breast and the so-called loco-regional lymph nodes to other parts of the body, typically the liver, lungs, or bone. And if you can get away with less surgery followed by radiation, I think that's generally leaves you with the fewest amount of long-term side effects and again, does not compromise your cure rate. So again, there are times where mastectomy is the favored procedure for one reason or another, and there's no way around that. But if lumpectomy is on the table and the surgeon says, I can adequately and successfully remove the tumor with lumpectomy, and then you'll need radiation afterwards, I do try to encourage patients to pursue that route.
And I think that's fair, and it's important to know that the actual chances of beating breast cancer are excellent with either choice, and there's not one that's better than the other in terms of beating breast cancer. Most women have an equally good chance of beating breast cancer with either lumpectomy or mastectomy. And I think, as I see my role as a surgeon, and I think it echoes a lot of what you were saying, both of you, is that I find my role when I come to work in the morning is to see if I can find a way to save a woman's breast. Is there a way, is there a pathway, is there an opportunity where we can adequately treat her breast cancer by preserving her breast? And then once we put that pathway together, and the pathway is different for different people. Sometimes it's a simple pathway, and sometimes it's a complex pathway. But then once we offer that pathway, it's up to a woman to decide, I want to walk that path or I don't. I'm accepting of that pathway or I don't. And the ones that say I'm not accepting of that pathway, who decide to do mastectomy, they should be encouraged and supported just as much as the lumpectomy patients, because it's a very personal choice. So I think we're all in agreement, and all of the things we do for women in terms of all the therapies sort of helps foster that and gives them the opportunities either way. So I think that's one of the biggest things that goes through a woman's mind initially about that. Now, just briefly, Dr. Stetson, if you could describe for women, because most women probably don't know, when they come for their radiation treatment, what do they expect that day? What is that like?
Sure.
What is done to them? How long does it take?
Because
they all ask how long it takes.
Yep.
So tell us what would happen to them that day.
Absolutely. So the first thing that will happen when they meet me is we'll have a consultation, right? So their first visit will be just a discussion with me. And this is where, you know, based on, pathology and results from the surgery and the imaging, and the staging workup, I make the recommendations in terms of what they need as far as radiation, right? It may be a very low-risk situation where they could be okay without radiation altogether. It could be that it's a high-risk situation where they need to get treated not only to the breast but also to all the surrounding lymph nodes.
Right.
So when I was entering residency a little over 15 years ago, everybody got kind of the same course of radiation, right? So the paradigm was lumpectomy or mastectomy followed by 6 weeks of radiation. Now it's very different. Our field has evolved a lot since then. And so now there is a whole gamut of regimens. There's not one size fits all. It could be as few as 5 treatments, or it could be, up to 5 or 6 weeks of radiation, although that's kind of slowly falling by the wayside.
So there's a wide range in the duration
of
radiation.
There's a wide range.
So a woman shows up for her radiation visit on a Monday. What's going to happen to her?
So that first visit, we discuss the different options. And come up with the one that I think makes the most sense and the one that the woman is most comfortable with. And then the next thing that will typically happen if she does undergo radiation is she will come for what we call a CT simulation or a mapping session. And this is a CAT scan that's done in the same position as she will be during treatment, which could be with her lying on her back or on her stomach. And then based on that CAT scan, we'll make the treatment plan. So this is a process that usually takes about a week or a week and a half where I work with my physics team.
Mm-hmm.
And we figure out how to get the right amount of radiation to our target, which would be the breast plus or minus some lymph nodes, while sparing the normal tissues, making the treatment safe. And once we do that and we have a plan in place, then she will start on her course. And as I said, this could be as few as 5 treatments or as many as 6 weeks of radiation, 5 days a week. It's a non-invasive procedure. External beam radiation is basically a high-energy X-ray. So it, as I tell my patients, it feels like getting an X-ray, meaning it doesn't feel like anything. While she's on treatment, we will see her for on-treatment visits just to make sure everything is going okay. And then after she finishes, we will follow her longitudinally.
How long is each treatment? How long is she laying there for the treatment?
So it depends. We have some techniques to reduce the dose of normal tissues like lung and the heart, which can make the treatment a little bit longer, but on average about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah,
and time out of her day is time to get there in 15 minutes and time afterwards.
Right. So we say as a rule of thumb just to give yourself about an hour.
Right.
But a lot of people can do it this at the beginning or end of their work day, on lunch break.
I think that's an important point. Many working women can still have radiation without it being inconvenient.
That's right.
They can go through their treatment. They can find a time in their day to do it, because that's what people are concerned about. And usually the staff and your department's very flexible in scheduling it around their lives. So I think that's useful for people to know. Dr. Cohen, what would people expect? What would a woman expect when she came for a medical oncology consultation the first day she walks in? What sort of things, just briefly, would you discuss with her? And how would that go? What's a typical discussion? Although everybody is different, what's a typical discussion?
So in medical oncology, we specialize in what's called the systemic treatment of breast cancer. And we have several different systemic medications or types of systemic medication that we can use to try to often to reduce the risk of the breast cancer recurring and spreading to other parts of the body in the future. It depends on the details of a specific breast cancer in terms of what types of systemic therapies that we would use. If a breast cancer is what we call hormone receptor positive, which is the case for about 80% of the breast cancers, then we're definitely talking about hormonal therapies or anti-estrogen therapies, which are generally pills to reduce the risk of recurrence of the breast cancer. In a hormone receptor negative breast cancer, and in some hormone receptor positive breast cancer, we do consider chemotherapy, particularly if there are lymph nodes involved or other high risk features.
Right.
And often it's a combination of different therapies that are involved. So say a patient might get their surgery first, and then if they have a high enough risk breast cancer, we would offer them some chemotherapy, and then they might follow with some radiation, and then finally we could put them on an anti-estrogen pill for generally anywhere from 5 to 10 years. There's also a third type of systemic therapy, which are called targeted therapies. And so we have various targets in breast cancer that have been identified through research over the last many years. And one of these targets is called HER2, and that's a protein that's on the surface of roughly 15 to 20% of breast cancer cells, or 15 to 20% of breast cancer cases, and patients who have HER2 positive breast cancer can benefit from the addition of what are called targeted therapies, or what's called monoclonal antibodies, which are very, very exquisitely specific drugs, again, that target that HER2 positive breast cancer and make our other therapies, our chemotherapy and so on, work better.
Great. Thank you very much for that. And if you were to tell a woman who's obviously apprehensive about medical oncology, if there's one thing you can tell them, or two things you would say about medical oncology that you really wanted a patient to know, what would you tell them? Two important things.
Well, I would tell them that, you know, we're really trying to offer as much treatment as they need to cure them of their breast cancer, but not more than that. And that whatever the treatment plan is, whether or not it involves chemotherapy or hormonal therapy or targeted therapies, we are going to try to make it as manageable as possible. We have a bunch of new tests that we can do to reduce the use of chemotherapy.
Right, right.
And so patients who may have gotten chemotherapy 15 years ago, before I came to Stony Brook, may now not need to get chemotherapy, because these tests help us discriminate who needs chemotherapy and who can safely avoid it. And then for the women who do need chemotherapy because their risk of recurrence is high enough and they have tumors that are likely to respond to the chemotherapy, we have a lot of good supportive treatments to get people through chemotherapy. We can prevent nausea. We can help with fatigue.
Sure.
We can treat all the symptoms that women develop with chemotherapy.
Right.
And I also always tell them it's not like a runaway train that you can't get off of. Once you start the chemotherapy, there are plenty of ways that we can modify things as we go along to make it manageable. So very few people, if any, are throwing up anymore or are, you know, bedbound or anything like that. The patients basically can live their lives normally, go to work, take care of their kids and so on. And if they have more side effects than we anticipate, we can always modify the regimen to make it manageable and get them through.
I think it's a very important point. I'm glad you brought it up. Dr. Stetson, one or two things you would tell a woman that's listening today, what she would really need to know about radiation oncology, something maybe she doesn't know that would make life a little easier for her.
Yeah, so I would say that the two big take-home messages are, one, that radiation is effective. We know from extensive body of literature that radiation, when given after surgery, can reduce the risk of a recurrence by anywhere between 50 and 70%, which is a lot. And the second thing to say is that radiation is safe. It's a well-tolerated mm-hmm. treatment. You know, the word radiation sounds very scary to a lot of people,
sure.
particularly if they don't know much about it.
Right.
You know, they can associate it with a lot of bad things. But radiation as a medical treatment modality is highly effective and very safe because it is very controlled. You know, the radiation that we use, the megavoltage beams, don't scatter all over the place. You know, we know exactly where it's going and how much each millimeter of tissue is getting.
Yes.
And our treatment techniques, our delivery, and our planning has evolved a great deal over time. And so, you know, every so often I will have a patient and say, well, listen, you know, my mom or my aunt had radiation 30 years ago and she was burned really badly, so I don't want to do
right.
it. And what I tell them is that we've come very far from where we were 30 years ago. And, you know, side effects that you can expect, a little bit of fatigue, maybe a little bit of this skin reaction, are typically short-lived and not very bothersome. So it's a safe and effective treatment.
And I think that's very important. Thank you for that. And people in the audience should also understand that the treatment they get is a team treatment. It's a team approach. We all work closely together. We wear the same coats with the same logos, and therefore we're in constant communication and constantly aware of what's going on, and we're able to monitor the patient across all the different specialties. So thank you guys very much for that. So the next part of this, or the next segment of this, is that we're going to try to answer some commonly asked questions by the most popular Google searches for breast cancer. And so we'll try to stick to short answers because there's several of them. But the first one, of course, is what causes breast cancer? Dr. Cohen, briefly, how would you answer that if you only
had a brief
Google answer?
It's very hard to answer briefly. Well, the short answer is, for any individual person, we don't really know what caused their breast cancer. There are patients who have a genetic abnormality, a BRCA1 or BRCA2 abnormality, or some other genetic mutation in their family that predisposes them to breast cancer. But that's the minority of patients. That's about 5% of all patients with
right.
breast cancer. For the most part, even though we do know some risk factors, you know, total lifetime estrogen exposure early, when you start your period early, or you have late menopause, or if you've never had children, or your first child was born later in life, those are all small risk factors that predispose to the risk of developing breast cancer. But in terms of what actually causes it, I think largely it's a random phenomenon that there are mutations that occur in breast cells all the time under the influence of various carcinogens in the environment. And the body has a way of controlling those and wiping those out most of the time. And every now and then a cancer cell is smart enough that it avoids the body's surveillance mechanisms, and it breaks through and it divides and eventually forms a tumor that we have to deal with.
Right. Yeah, right. Two basic ideas would be, one, there's a gene that flips on and causes cancer, or there is a protective gene that's defective and doesn't turn off a growing cancer. So those are the two broad spectrums. Dr. Stassen, anything else to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think Dr. Cohen covered it pretty well. It's,
okay.
You know, there are obviously environmental risk factors.
Yep.
There are some genetic risk factors, but the short answer is we don't know.
We don't know exactly. Very good. Thank you.
But we do know that it's quite common, and
yes.
1 out of 8 women will develop breast cancer during their lifetime. And so it is, unfortunately, something that a lot of women have to deal with. But fortunately, the treatments are very effective, and the vast majority of women with breast cancer are cured by our multimodality therapies.
Well, you must have done your homework, because the second part of that question is how common is it? So you've already asked that. You've already answered that.
Yeah. No, and I think this is a very important point to also kind of bring up, that this is very common, because every woman who gets diagnosed, you know, has this question in her mind, why me? And
yeah.
the answer is, well, this is, you know, 12% of all women will at some point in their life get
right.
breast cancer.
Yeah.
And thankfully, the majority of them will be just
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, without having done anything wrong, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
there's no, everybody wants to, my experience is that my patients want to find out what caused it.
Right.
Not just for curiosity, because then they can tell all their loved ones, don't do this.
Right.
Right. This is what caused it. Avoid this. And there's really nothing that you can do except for, you know, a few things, but there's not a lot they can do. It happens to them without them doing anything wrong.
Right, right? But if there is something that they should tell their loved ones, is get screened, get...
Well, that's the next question. What are the early signs for breast cancer, and when should a woman see a doctor? Right. Why don't you start with that one?
Sure. Well, so, you know, as I just alluded to, I mean, I think the key thing is surveillance and early screening. And in general, in the U.S., we're very good at that, right? And that's why, you know, so over the years, I've done a lot of work in global health arena. And, you know, if you look at 5-year survival rates for breast cancer in the U.S., it's, you know, it's upward of 95%. In some other countries, it's 10%, and the difference is early detection, right?
Right.
So, you know, for most women, they don't have any early signs, right? It gets picked up on routine screening mammogram, as it should be, and by and large, those are the cases that are going to be cured. But then some women do present, obviously, with some clinical signs,
sure.
even early on. It could be a palpable lump. Or, you know, which could be pea-sized or it could be bigger. It could be an inversion of the nipple. It could be some discharge, some asymmetry that they feel in the breast. But, you know, I think nowadays more and more just get picked up on routine screening.
And even in the most sophisticated neighborhoods and parts of this country, still the only probably it reaches its height at about 70% of eligible women get screened. Right. So still, even in the most sophisticated areas of our country, 70% tops out the percent of women in the screening group that actually get screened. So, again, this is an informative discussion, but also an awareness discussion because it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and women, generally speaking, should start annual screening mammograms at 40. And if their mammogram report says it's dense, they should ask for an ultrasound. And a particular woman should ask her own physician about whether a mammogram and an ultrasound is enough for her or if she needs something else, because it's not one size fits all. It could be risk adjusted in terms of what somebody needs for screening. The,
sure.
the ideal screening for someone is not the same for everybody. So there's more attention should be paid for that. But really, just go out. We would all just urge women in screening ages over the age of 40 to go out and get your mammogram every year.
Absolutely.
What modern treatments are being used for breast cancer at Stony Brook? I think you each maybe touched on this. You talked a little bit about the precision of radiation and the targeting and the ability to deliver effective radiation without damaging other tissues.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us just a little more about what we're doing at Stony Brook to spare the other tissues the necessary radiation to the
sure,
breast.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So we have a number of tools to do that. It could be something as simple as positioning, right? So as I mentioned before, a woman can have her treatment lying on her back or lying on her stomach where the breast essentially falls into a cutout and the breast tissue falls away from the chest
right.
wall and the heart and lung. And that could be the simplest way to basically minimize all the dose to the surrounding tissues that we need to spare. In other situations where that can't be done, we can do something called a deep inspiratory breath hold where the woman inhales and holds her breath for about 15, 20 seconds at a time. And what that does is it expands the lungs. It maximizes the distance between the heart and
right.
The area that we're treating. And again, it makes the treatment safer. We also have more conformal ways of treatment planning. We can use something called IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy, which really kind of shapes the radiation field and
sure.
makes it conform very closely
right.
to the area that we're treating.
Sparing other areas.
Sparing other areas, right. And nowadays we can really modulate the dose a lot where we can deliver different amounts of radiation dose within each treatment to different areas. That's something called SIB or simultaneous integrated boost. So we've gotten a lot more sophisticated in terms of the treatment planning and the treatment delivery. And it makes it not only more effective and more safe, but it also condenses the number of treatments. So now we can, you know, the reason why traditionally radiation was delivered over 6 weeks is because the classical radiation biology teaching is this is what you need to do to make the treatment safe for normal tissues. You break it up into small daily installments. Now we're
right.
discovering more and more that we actually don't need to do that as long as we utilize our modern treatment planning techniques and kind of a more sophisticated understanding of radiation biology, we can actually get the same thing done safely.
Right. And, the most typical post-lumpectomy radiation used to be 6 or 7 weeks, and now it's 4 weeks.
Not anymore,
right.
yeah.
And Dr. Cohen, when I read a question about new treatments at Stony Brook, my mind already goes to clinical trials, because if there's anything that's new, it's clinical trials and research, and it's something that we can do here at Academic Medical Center that many others can't. Are there one or two really exciting new trials at Stony Brook that we're looking at from a medical oncology point of view, and maybe tell us about that.
Sure. You know, so I like to say that there are two types of clinical trial, broadly speaking. There are clinical trials that are designed to improve the efficacy of treatment and clinical trials that are intended to reduce the toxicity of treatment. And we have both kinds of clinical trials here. So we have some trials where patients have the option to participate and are offered standard, say, chemotherapy or sort of lower tier of chemotherapy. Often patients are randomized. They don't get to make that choice if they participate in the trial, but it's made for them, which can be a barrier to enrollment because people sometimes have a hard time accepting the fact or the randomization by a computer. However, there are a lot of good reasons to participate in those trials because at the very least, you're going to get the standard of care therapy.
Right.
And half the time you might get a less toxic therapy. And there's also data that suggests that participation in clinical trials in general is associated with improved outcome just because of probably the scrutiny that's involved with participating in a clinical trial. And you're watched very carefully by not only your physician and your team of physicians, but by the whole clinical trial team
right.
and the ethics committee and so on. And then we have trials to improve the efficacy of treatment. So we have new drugs that are being studied that are very close to FDA approval, and we have some drugs that are a little farther from FDA approval. We have what are called the oral SERDs that are being looked at, and these are anti-estrogen drugs, selective estrogen receptor degraders that are sort of the latest and greatest in the anti-estrogen class, and these look like they may be better than some of our existing anti-estrogens.
Okay.
So patients have the opportunity to enroll in those trials and get the benefit of those new drugs. We have novel chemotherapy agents. We have a class of medicines called antibody-drug conjugates, which combine the exquisite targeting and specificity of monoclonal antibodies to various breast cancer targets, but these drugs are conjugated or attached to chemotherapy molecules so they can deliver the chemotherapy directly to a breast cancer cell and minimize the negative effects on normal tissues in the body. So again, a lot of exciting clinical trials that are available at Stony Brook that patients are welcome to ask about.
Great, great. Thank you very much for that answer. And those are very important issues that women should know. Is there anything else from a research point of view, Dr. Stetson, in your
field? Yeah, so,
your
in radiation for breast cancer, I think the overarching question that we're trying to answer in terms of research is who needs less and who needs more,
mm-hmm.
right? So really identify those groups of women for whom less is more. Right, who sometimes may be okay with just irradiating part of the breast,
right.
Or not at all, versus those women who may have more resilient, more radio-resistant disease, you know, who may may benefit from dose escalation or something like that. And so this is where a lot of research is being done, and I think it's very beneficial.
And I would say from a surgical point of view, we are now identifying women who sort of may be able to have what would be commonly called a breast reduction at the time of lumpectomy. Years ago, we had women who would have a lumpectomy and radiation and have some pretty major asymmetry and still have a large sort of breast that's presenting problems for them. And then once the radiation is delivered, you know, to do a reduction mammoplasty or breast reduction is very difficult after that. The healing
right.
is unpredictable
right.
after radiation. There's scar tissue, lumps are forming. So now we're identifying women up front who maybe their whole life have thought about having a breast reduction. And now we're able to do that with the plastic surgeon at the time of the lumpectomy. And in fact, it helps us take a bigger piece out and a bigger margin because the intention is breast reduction.
Right.
So we're now combining this as an oncoplastic procedure. We're able to frequently offer a woman a lumpectomy with reduction mammoplasty and offer breast preservation for women with larger tumors who historically have been getting mastectomy because of their tumor size, because we're able to reconstruct the breast in a more favorable way. So we've really been pushing the envelope in that regard, and it's been very helpful to
yeah.
women.
And,
yeah.
and the additional benefit of that is that it also helps with the radiation. What we know is the biggest predictor of acute toxicity of radiation, right, which is, what is that, right? It's the skin reaction, the dermatitis, the breast swelling, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of skin breakdown and peeling and so forth. And the biggest predictor of that is amount of breast tissue. So women with very pendulous breasts, who have a lot more, you know, breast tissue, can get more severe acute toxicity. And so what breast reduction does, aside from everything that you mentioned, is it actually makes the radiation better tolerated. So
it's, right. That's a very important point. Well, I've been here the longest for sure, but I'm blessed and lucky to have such great colleagues working alongside me and everybody else. We have a wonderful team. So I thank all of you for all the efforts and all the efforts you put forward for our patients and all the hard work you do and other team members that aren't here today, right? Our nurses and social workers and other physicians. So, you know, we're all here for our patients, and we work as a team at Stony Brook, and we thank you for joining us today. It really was, I think, very informative. I certainly learned some things today, which was really fantastic. Thank you for joining us, and I thank the audience for joining us. And please, go get your mammogram. It is October, and tell one other woman that you know to get a mammogram. Thanks for joining us.
Stony Brook Medicine is Long Island's premier academic medical center. We transform lives through scientific discovery, education, and care, and we bring together innovative research, advanced education, and extraordinary healthcare expertise to set the standard for how healthy communities thrive. For more information, visit stonybrookmedicine.edu or follow us on social media, Stony Brook Medicine on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn, and Stony Brook Med on X.